The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us for KORC News, Music, and Civics, a program heard every Sunday from 1 to 2 p.m. here on KORC 105.9 LPFM, Corvallis, Oregon. You can stream us worldwide at korcfm.com, where you can learn more about the station, you can see our schedule, our volunteers, and you can learn more about donating to this nonprofit, independent community radio station that seeks to serve the public through diverse music and local involvement. Every Sunday afternoon, from 1 to 2, we like to devote the hour to what is happening locally and featuring the voices of local community members talking about a range of topics. If you would like to be involved in what we are doing at KORC, whether with this program or if maybe you're interested in contributing in some other way, there are many volunteer opportunities at this community radio station. You can send an email to info@korcfm.com. And we will be in touch with you. Today is Sunday, January 28th, and earlier this week, Benton County welcomed the public to observe a new fire evacuation route serving the Oak Creek Valley just west of Corvallis. We're going to open today's program with audio from this event, which took place this past Wednesday. This was a collaborative effort that took the cooperation of community members, the county, the university, the Benton Community Foundation, and even the legislative level. The project was unveiled to the public this past Wednesday, and we'll start with Senator Sarah Gelser-Bluen, who was involved in drafting legislation related to this project. This is the senator addressing the crowd that assembled at the Benton County Kalapuya Building on Research Way just before the departure of the tour this past Wednesday.
Such an exciting project, and I'm really looking forward to going out and seeing it today. Like others, I hope that it is never ever needed. But as others have pointed out, I received an email several years ago from Anne, and it was so detailed and so well put together and so explicit in what the ask was to do that it would be impossible to say no to that. I mean, try to say no to Anne, you can't do that. So we began to work on the project, and it was during COVID, and we had this ARPA money, and there was a point in time where legislators were told, you have a couple of million dollars that you get to allocate in your community. You have 2 weeks to figure it out, and it has to be something that's ready to go and can be completed within 2 years. And immediately I thought, go get that email from Anne. I think they need some money over there to complete that. So it is really exciting to see the way that came together. And it's interesting, in Oregon, many of those ARPA funds across the state went to fire safety efforts. And I think that's because in Oregon, the pandemic really did coincide with a growing awareness of our future with climate change and fire and how much closer it is coming to communities. So I hope that we never have to use this, and I'm just grateful to everyone that is working so hard to prepare. And thank you to the community. This is a project that happened because people wrote to their commissioners, their university, their fire protection district, their legislators, so keep sending all of those letters. That's what makes change happen.
After concluding these remarks, Senator Gelser-Bluen and other participants boarded a few shuttle buses to head to the site of the new evacuation route. Public Works Director Gary Stockhoff and Emergency Manager Brian Lee gave insight on the route while the shuttle buses made their way to the site.
Generally, when we send people out these rural evacuation routes, we almost consider it what we call a last-ditch effort. We really want people to take the paved routes out, the main routes out. They're going to be the safest and the most available. And those are the same routes that law enforcement and fire are going to prioritize keeping open. So during big fires, if they need to clear evacuation routes, they're going to clear the main paved routes first, including the sides of the roads. They'll do emergency logging operations. They'll do whatever they need to do to make it safe. These rural routes will be prioritized last. So we want to remind the public that that's a really important piece of this puzzle.
Some of the residents who attended the event conversed with the county officials during the ride with a handful of inquiries about available turnouts, cistern management along the route, as well as overall preparations being considered by the various partners on the project.
We really just want folks to start taking this really seriously. This ice storm recently kind of caught us all off guard and reframed the way we're thinking about emergencies here. And we often hear a lot of people say, especially for Benton County, oh, a wildfire will never happen here. It can't happen. It can't burn down Corvallis. It can't happen here. There's too much moisture. But what we're seeing, of course, with the impacts of climate change and just the changing climate in general, is that this is becoming our reality.
Before the new evacuation route, the community was dispersed throughout the valley with limited public roadways and only one road access point. The Oak Creek Valley is located immediately west of Corvallis. It is a 7,730-acre basin, which rises 1,841 feet from the valley floor. The basin is dominated by conifer forest cover in the upper basin, and a mix of conifer and oak forest and field in the mid to lower basin area. Although average precipitation in Corvallis is a little over 44 inches per year, during the summer months, there is little to no precipitation most years, creating fire-prone conditions. This year is an El Niño year, meaning a hotter, drier summer than usual. Land use in the basin includes residential, forestry, agriculture, and recreation. Land ownership there is a mix of private and public. The largest landowners with over 100 acres include the State of Oregon and Oregon State University, Starker Forest, Greenbelt Land Trust, Crestmont Farms LLC, Benton County, the Brandis family, the City of Corvallis, and the Martin family. The remaining properties are smaller private holdings and are mostly residential. The Oak Creek Valley residential community is made up of about 370 households, loosely clustered within 10 neighborhoods, with an estimated population of 1,100 people. This community is within the Wildland Urban Interface, also known as the WUI. Forested WUI areas, such as Oak Creek Valley, are at high risk for wildfire. In addition to Oak Creek Drive, there are an estimated 20 miles of side roads and driveways within the community. These roadways are a mix of paved and gravel, and they are maintained by neighborhood road districts, homeowner associations, or informal homeowner groups. These roads are generally relatively narrow, and some are built on steep slopes. Involvement and cooperation with both landowners and land managers has been very key in this process. Along the evacuation route of the January 24th tour, the shuttle buses came to a stop at the OSU Lamb Farm, situated on a hillside overlooking a foggy, misty, rain-soaked valley that day. It was noted that while this location has a vast view overlooking the Oak Creek Valley, in a wildfire situation, the smoke would obscure the view, adding to the complications of evacuating. Public Works Director Gary Stockoff and Emergency Manager Brian Lee addressed the crowd of about 25 attendees gathered at the OSU Lamb Farm along the route. Here is Public Works Director Gary Stockoff.
The design itself took a couple years to get through the permitting and the design, and I have to say, working with the university and Corvallis Rural Fire and all the other partners, that it really was a group effort. Ian is the engineer. Ian didn't want to really say anything, but I can tell you he's an awesome engineer, and he did the heavy lifting to get this to where it's at today. And we joke, it took 2 years to get it done, and they had the road in 1 week. And so we appreciate that. And again, we've worked with Brian and the sheriff and emergency management and the local folks to keep this thing moving. And it's where you're at now. And I think I've heard it said, you know, we hope we don't have to use it for a real one. It's there, obviously, for practice, and we look forward to, you know, how you guys handle that. We're glad that we finally were able to do this. And everybody that helped with the funding, it's awesome. When we did the design, there is a wetland. We avoided it. We worked with the university on how to minimize the impact. It's not a wide road, as you'll see. It's the bare minimum. But there are pullouts on the top that if something happens, we can get somebody off and still be able to use the site. So we really were trying to be very sensitive to the terrain, the farm, and the impact we had, and keep the cost down. So we tried to minimize cuts and all that as went through. And that, again, that was a heavy lift that Ian oversaw that process.
Last thing on evacuation, while we talk vehicles and whether or not they can make it, the other side of this is if they have to, people can still evacuate on foot. So it's not preferable. It's obviously up a hill. There's access functional need limitations related to this that are a major problem. But again, when we're talking evacuations, everything's on the table. Bicycles, foot traffic, everything. So this is still another route. And if you look at the landscape and the space, it's actually quite a safe route comparatively compared to going through, for example, McDonald Dunn Forest with all the trees and overhangs and additional turnouts. This is actually a very good route to go out. The other thing we always want to remind the public and, again, your constituents and your colleagues is to listen to the first responders who are on scene about where to go and how to get out. The last thing we want is for everyone to assume this is a new route. This is a great thing. This is the route we're going to take, especially if there's other routes that might be better used or more safe. Gary mentioned the Ball Hill Land Trust route out. While it's a bike path, that would definitely get ruined by driving on it. That could in many ways be a safer route depending on where the fire is moving and what situations we have. So there's a lot of circumstances where this route and how this route would be used. And there's lots of nuances there, but this is a huge accomplishment and a huge collaboration. And without the partnerships and actually the efforts from Oak Creek and the Corrales Rural Fire, this would not be possible at all. So as we move forward, we want to take the nuggets and lessons learned from this effort and apply them to other communities and actually make it a model for other areas and other counties, because this same challenge that we're facing here and that Oak Creek is facing is modeled everywhere else. If you look at the population and the numbers of people out the Oak Creek subdivision area, it's really a high population, and it's a really big concern for those of us around Benton County who are focused on emergency planning. It's one of our biggest concerns, actually, for the community. So this effort's going to keep moving forward. We're going to keep working on plans. And actually, hopefully in May or June, we're going to get to do an evacuation drill again and run a test and run at least a few people, probably not everyone in Oak Creek, but a handful of folks out this route, check times, check processes, and see how that process works. We've learned many lessons doing that. Some of those really need to get refined. So we're looking forward to that opportunity. This really does show how organized community members can be and what can be done to accomplish their objective. Evacuations are a number one concern of ours, and it's really we'll call it an art form, not a science, of trying to nail down evacuation processes, protocols, and modeling. So we're going to start working with some more traffic modeling to figure out what routes make the most sense and how to maximize the routes and the space and the money that's available to get people to safety. So really starting to focus on rural, lower income, different areas like that.
The voice of Benton County Emergency Manager Brian Lee, speaking along the evacuation route tour that took place on January 24th. At the conclusion of the tour, I had a chance to speak with Senator Sarah Gelser-Bluen, who represents Oregon's District 8, and was among the partners who made this project a reality. In a few moments, we'll hear the voices of Ann Isinger, the resident who spearheaded this effort several years back, and we'll conclude with Chris Kwaka, the president and CEO of the Benton Community Foundation, who helped coordinate funding for this project. Thanks for your time today. I understand this is quite a multifaceted process in getting an evacuation route going, and it involved members of the community, the county, the university, as well as the legislative level. Why don't you talk a little bit about the legislative involvement in this evacuation route?
Well, the work of this really was done by the community, the county, the Rural Fire Protection District. And as they were working on this project, they stumbled across a problem in the statute that the law that made it very difficult for the Rural Fire Protection District to coordinate with these other partners to put in a much needed evacuation route. So they came to the legislature and asked for help in changing the law to clear that obstacle out of the way. And that happened to be during the pandemic when we had some extra money that was available to allocate to communities for emergency needs that could be for projects that could be completed right away. And so we were able to take some of that money to pour in to this project to allow it to be completed, and also to have that excess go into completing the wildfire assessments, safety assessments in other areas of the county where there is this risk. And because of climate change, we are going to continue to see more fires, and we really have to be working towards mitigating what that will look like and how to get people out safely.
Without changing the law, something like building an evacuation route more complicated?
This particular evacuation route would have been very difficult to complete because there was a question about whether or not the Rural Fire Protection District had the authority to even participate in the planning, the upkeep, and the construction. So this was necessary to make that clear. We were very careful to make sure that we were not taking people's property away from them involuntarily. We were not mandating that any Rural Fire Protection District do anything in particular. But what we needed to do was give them the flexibility to make those decisions at the local level.
Is it often that there are projects that are up for grabs as far as, you know, community or government funding where people can maybe place a vote on the level of importance of projects?
That hardly ever happens. I've been in the legislature for nearly 20 years. It's the only time it happened. And I don't really think it's the best process. This was a good outcome, but having individuals choose among projects that they're aware of without a public process has its challenges. It was necessary at that time. The federal government gave us a bunch of money to spend really quickly, and we wanted to make sure it was equally distributed across the state. And so what we saw were really important local projects that didn't cost as much to get that level of priority for a bond or a vote, but were also really essential. So it was unusual, and I'm glad that this aligned with that situation so we could get this rebuilt.
Were you very involved in this process, or did you just have to sign off on a couple of things?
I was involved in drafting legislation to be able to resolve that statutory issue, working with folks that were testifying, working with members of the lobby and those that had concerns about the measure in order to get that passed, working with leadership to make sure that it got passed and didn't get left on the table. And then with the money, it really was a matter of getting the information and facilitating that vetting with the Department of Administrative Services, and then just waiting to hear what happened next. And it's really great to be able to see a tangible outcome. We don't always get to do that in the legislature, and that was pretty exciting.
Do you feel pretty excited after seeing the evacuation route today?
I was impressed with the route, and it also made me really grateful for all the people that work in our community. You look at that road, it's short, it does not look like a fancy thing, and that is dozens and dozens of people, citizens, government agencies, nonprofit agencies, volunteers, working, planning, problem solving to make that happen so it's there when someone needs it. And it just makes me think about all the things in our community that we just take for granted are there, and all the people that are behind making that happen.
Government can work, and it should work. It just takes a collaboration and the right people showing up.
Absolutely, and people asking for what they need. And I think that is the bottom line of this. Those neighbors, that neighborhood, really stuck with the process and came forward with a need and ideas for solutions. So that was a really important ingredient in it, too.
Well, Sarah Gelser-Bluen, thank you very much for your time today and for coming to the event.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for being there.
Recorded on Wednesday, that was Senator Sarah Gelser-Bluen, following the unveiling of the new fire evacuation route serving the Oak Creek Valley. That audio is part of a full episode of the Benton County Public Podcast from Episode 8, which is slated to be released this coming week. You can listen to all episodes of the Benton County Public Podcast by doing an internet search for Benton County Public Podcast. It exists on several platforms, and it's a product of Benton County government. My name is Dan Krall, and I am the producer and host of the Benton County Public Podcast, which is separate from KORC. And you are listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics, which is every Sunday afternoon from 1 to 2 here on KORC Community Radio for Corvallis. And on this program, we feature voices in the community, and we cover a range of topics. Still to come this hour, KORC's Lava Lamp Larry is going to interview several performers in the upcoming International Guitar Festival, taking place at the Whiteside Theater this coming Saturday. We also have a Community Voices segment with Marge Pop. But next, as Corvallis faces ongoing struggles providing adequate services to unhoused individuals, a mental health crisis that certainly extends beyond just this town's borders, rent that is unaffordable to much of the city's population, an infrastructure and public right-of-way that has certainly seen better days, an issue holding up city business and bringing unsavory online attention to the Corvallis City Council regarding the dubious ousting of a city councilor by the unelected city manager Mark Shepard, has the attention of much of the city's residents. Nick Martin has the latest.
You're listening to KORC. I'm Nick Martin. The due process hearing for Ward 5 Councilor Charlene Ellis has been postponed again. According to a release from the city, the attorney representing her filed a lawsuit this week in the Benton County Circuit Court seeking a preliminary injunction to stop the hearing process. This is the third time the hearing has been postponed, with the most recent rescheduled date set to the February 5th council meeting, the one that has been postponed. As we've reported before, Councilor Ellis is being accused of violating the city charter. The allegation stems from comments she made during a September 18th council meeting, in which she made a motion to direct City Manager Mark Shepard to post a job opening for a climate specialist for the Climate Action Advisory Board, or CAB. It was this proposed motion that got her into trouble. Here is her making the motion.
The first one is that the Climate Action Advisory Board requests that the council direct the city manager to post the full-time job position of climate program specialist within 2 weeks and provide an update on the hiring process every meeting until filled.
So what exactly is Councilor Ellis accused of? According to a resolution intended to be presented at the December 4th council meeting, her actions at both the September 13th meeting and the subsequent September 18th city council meeting violated Section 23, subsection F of the Charter, which refers to interference in administration and elections. The section states, quote, "Neither the mayor nor any member of the council shall in any manner, directly or indirectly, by suggestion or otherwise, attempt to influence or coerce the manager in the making of any appointment or removal of any officer or employee. A violation of the foregoing provisions of this section shall forfeit the office of the offender." For some background, the Climate Action Advisory Board is a body tasked with helping Corvallis meet the greenhouse gas emissions target set forth in the Corvallis Climate Action Plan and to make policy recommendations to the City Council in that regard when needed. Councilor Ellis both chairs the group as well as acts as council liaison. The group utilizes the skills of a climate specialist to help with meeting operations as well as work to secure funds related to climate initiatives, among other things. Two people previously holding this position had since left, leaving a gap. It was this gap the board discussed at that September 13th CAB meeting. Fearing the advisory board would not be able to continue meeting due to this vacancy, a motion was passed to bring this vacancy-filling request to the next city council meeting. Fast forward to that city council meeting on the 18th, where Ellis made her motion we heard earlier. It is those two moments that are the focus of the accusations. As it stands right now, both the city and Councilor Ellis have sought their own legal representation in preparation for the hearing, which will essentially act as a trial where each side will get opportunities to submit evidence and cross-examine witnesses. A rescheduled date has not yet been set. This is Nick Martin with KORC.
This is KORC News, Music, and Civics with JC. A top UN court orders Israel to prevent genocide in Gaza, but stopped short of ordering a ceasefire. According to the Associated Press, the United Nations top court on Friday ordered Israel to do all it can to prevent death, destruction, and acts of genocide in Gaza, but the panel stopped short of ordering Jerusalem to end the military offensive that has laid waste to the Palestinian enclave. In a ruling that will keep Israel under the legal lens for years to come, the court offered little other comfort to Israel in a genocide case brought by South Africa that goes to the core of one of the world's most intractable conflicts. The court's half-dozen orders will be difficult to achieve without some sort of ceasefire or pause in the fighting. Quote, "The court is acutely aware of the extent of the human tragedy that is unfolding in the region and is deeply concerned about the continuing loss of life and human suffering," unquote, said Court President Joan Donahue. The ruling amounted to an overwhelming rebuke of Israel's wartime conduct and added to mounting international pressure to halt the nearly four-month-old offensive, which has killed more than 26,000 Palestinians, decimated vast swaths of Gaza, and has driven nearly 85% of its 2.3 million people from their homes. Allowing the acquisitions to stand stung the government of Israel, which was founded as a Jewish state after the Nazi slaughter of 6 million Jews during World War II. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said the fact that the court was willing to discuss the genocide charges was a, quote, "mark of shame that will not be erased for generations," unquote. He also vowed to press ahead with the war. The power of the ruling was magnified by its timing, coming on the eve of the International Holocaust Remembrance Day. Listeners, you can be involved in pro-Palestinian and anti-genocide rallies every Saturday at noon in front of the Corvallis Courthouse. There is a weekly rally for Palestine, and you can participate in that and learn more about how to get involved locally. This is KORC, News, Music, and Civics, with JC.
Hi, it's Lava Lamp Larry for KORC. Hey, International Guitar Night is coming to Corvallis on Saturday, February 3rd, and I interviewed the four guitarists who will be appearing. They come from Vietnam, Brazil, Australia, and Italy, and they're fantastic. Before we get into the interviews, let's listen to a little bit of Marco Pereira. I'll be talking today with Luca Stricagnoli from Italy, Tu Le from Vietnam, Marco Pereira from Brazil, and Minnie Marks from Australia. Now, the first thing I want to ask you is, have you met before? Have you known each other before? Because now you're traveling together on this two-month tour that started the other day and will come to Corvallis in a couple of weeks, and then you'll go into March. So have the four of you known each other for a while? Have you played together before? Have you met each other? Or is this all where you've just been thrown together for the first time?
Well, so I'm the only one in the group that had a chance to know Minnie and Tu in different occasions, but the other three, they never met each other. So, yeah, we sort of all got together for the first time, we could say, to sum up. I toured previously with Minnie, and I toured with Tu. I never toured with Marco, and yeah, so they did not know each other.
Whose idea was it that you start a tour in the middle of January in Alaska? Right now you're in Anchorage, Alaska. Whose idea was that?
We're still looking for this person because we want to do revenge. You know? No, it's so that The agent is Herschel Freeman, and the organizer, as you know, is Brian Gore. And yeah, seems apparently this is like it's a cold season, but it's a hot season for concerts. So
yeah, it sure is. That's Luca Stricagnoli from Italy. And if you've never heard one doing Iron Maiden on acoustic guitar, let's listen to a little bit of what he can do with it. People who want more information about this, go to internationalguitarnight.com. And the thing that I appreciate about this the most is that each of you play in a very completely different style. Marco is a Brazilian guitarist, so it appears that he plays some of the traditional sambas and such from Brazil. Minnie, I don't know exactly what happens in Australia, but Minnie is a great blues player, a slide player. Thu is a classical player. And Luca, you're sort of the different bird here. You are you play primarily acoustic guitar, but you're playing rock songs that will probably be familiar to most people. What was the influence, or how did you come to play those kind of songs in a style that is really very unique?
Well, I'm like I like to arrange songs that I love. So most of the times they're rock because I happen to like rock. But sometimes it happens that I arrange some classical songs, pop songs, and metal songs, really all sort of styles. And I think the particular style developed gradually. You know, every time I had some sort of strange idea and I publish it on the internet, you know, I received like a certain feedback that made me feel like keep going in that direction. And gradually things got weirder and weirder until I found myself with a guitar with three necks.
And this three neck guitar that, and by the way, Luca has had something like 100 million views of his YouTube videos. So if you're one of the four people that haven't seen one of his YouTube videos, you really need to go check these out. Luca Stricagnoli, Stricagnoli. Actually, I read now that you've had over 200 million of viewings on YouTube. That is amazing. You're considered to be one of the most unique guitarists in the world. And maybe that's because you play like a three-necked guitar from time to time, and you've invented some pieces that go with your to sort of utilize the playing style that you have. So one of the things I've noticed that you do is you have what appears to be a three-string bass neck that you slap on the guitar body, and then you play that with your right hand while you're fingering with your left hand. And you do a lot of that left-hand finger-style stuff, but why didn't you just get a Chapman stick? You could have done that. You could have done that all with one instrument.
Because on the Chapman stick, you cannot play percussion, essentially. So the reason, so the third neck you're talking about is essentially the first reversed neck. And the reason I asked the guitar maker, his name is Davide Serracini, to reverse the neck is that by having it the other way around, you can tap notes and you can play percussion at the same time using just one arm. And also, the three necks of the guitar can be played all at the same time. So overall, with that instrument, you can play sort of easily four voices contemporarily.
Yeah, it's amazing to see. Now I play guitar. I am nowhere near the level of any of you. I am nowhere near half the level of any of you. But what I absolutely love is just the creativity, how you have created this style that is really unique, and it's just something to behold. So again, please come to the show at the White Side on February 3rd and see for yourself. Let me ask, Thu, you live in Bahrain, and you were born in Vietnam, and yet your style is Baroque, classical, romantic, and I know that your father was your teacher and your influence. What is it that you listen to when you're not playing guitar?
Actually, as a classical guitarist, I listened to a lot of classical music. Also, it was a part of my studying. But in fact, I listened to all type of music, you know, like rock, jazz. Jazz is also my, I would say, second favorite after classical. I listened to Luca Tritagnoli. I have a big genres in my playlist because... For me, I think it's important to know about all style of music. And then eventually, like now, in the classical repertoire, we have a lot of modern pieces which also get influenced from jazz or many styles. You know, like myself, I also play a lot of Latin American music, which I'm very happy to be here with Marco Pereira, that I could also learn and get inspiration for Brazilian music.
Yeah, it's great stuff. I wanted to make note that you passed the entrance exam for the National Conservatory of Music in Hanoi at the age of 7. When I hear of people accomplishing that level of play when they're 7 years old, it makes me want to, and I have 10 guitars here in my closet, it makes me want to put them all in a big pile and just burn them.
Yeah, you know, kindergarten was our space, was not enough space, so, you know, I have to go to music conservatory instead.
Let's listen to a little bit of the classical guitar of Thu Le. Next is Marco Pereira, who was born in Sao Paulo and got classical guitar lessons with a Uruguayan master, Isaias Savio. I'm probably brutalizing these names. You have a classical guitar master's degree and performance degree, and a master's in musicology from the University of Paris Sorbonne. And what is it that you do professionally? I mean, other than obviously play and release music, but you continue to teach, do you not?
Yeah, I'm retired right now after 6 months, but I've been teaching for maybe 37 years at the university, and I'll start playing just for fun, but I could stay with the guitar for maybe 8, 9, 10 hours a day, and my mother saw that and had the feeling that it could be something, and she sent me to a conservatory, and then I started learning the classical guitar, and they stayed there for a while. This is my background real is it's classical, especially for technique. But then I went to Paris to do my studies there. Then I went to the University of Paris, and I met some jazz musicians, and they blew my mind. And I tried to keep all the influences of the music, Brazilian music, of course, that I had in my childhood, and then the classical background, and also the freedom that we have for create the things in the jazz path. And well, then I tried to keep all together, and doing something that the essence were Brazilian. I mean, especially for the rhythms that I like a lot, this kind of Brazilian swing, different from different parts of the country, and I try to keep this in the music I do.
Just like in America, where you have blues and jazz and rock and country and so on and so forth, that every country has a variety of styles. I have a real love for Brazilian music, but I have not begun to discover all of the different styles that come out of Brazil, and they're all completely fascinating and just completely beautiful, I feel as well. Okay, thank you. Let's get Minnie up here next. You are
Hi.
Good day.
Good day.
You're not just an electric player, but you're a singer, a songwriter. I've seen at least a couple of videos where you're playing basically a drum, a kick drum, along with your slide playing. Where did you come to that style?
Many years of traveling around Australia playing gigs, trying to be as loud as I possibly could. I started off playing a cajon with my foot, so it was kick and snare, and then I wanted to upgrade, so I found a company over here in Michigan called Farmer Foot Drums. So it's essentially a whole drum kit, so kick, hat, snare, and a little crash cymbal as well. So, and now I just can't live without it, really. It's if I don't have it, then I feel naked.
We wouldn't want that. Many guitarists, when they play, they're going to tap their feet, and so you're essentially just doing the same thing, but you're really playing this kick drum. And do you did it take a while to maybe separate the amount, the level of sound from that kick drum from your guitar playing, so that it didn't really interfere with your fingering?
Kind of. I actually purchased it when I was over in Germany, and I finished my tour over there, and I decided to get it shipped to Australia, and I left my cajon in Germany, and it was I had a gig the next day in Australia, so it was I had to learn it that day, so it was either do or die kind of thing. So I mean, it definitely was weird to start off with, but as soon as, I think, with any kind of drum playing, as soon as the neuropaths kind of connect in your brain, then it's more like dancing now. So I feel like I'm dancing.
Yeah. So you didn't leave your heart in San Francisco. You left your cajon in Germany.
Yeah. Boris. His name's Boris. He's still over there, but he's been well looked after.
What do you listen to when you're not playing?
Oh, hooly dooly. I listen to a bunch of things. I listen to a lot of kind of blues, a lot of Motown. I love Bonnie Raitt. I love Little Feat. Anything kind of slide playing. But it depends on the day, really, what I want to listen to. But, yeah, they're a few of my favorites.
Okay. Well, those are some good favorites to have. Well,
absolutely.
Yeah. I want to thank all of you for sharing your music and for sharing some time with our listeners. And I definitely want to encourage everyone to come and see the International Guitar Night Tour when it reaches the Whiteside Theater in Corvallis. I want to thank all of you. I hope that you stay warm in Alaska, and I hope to see you down here soon. Be safe, travel safe, and thanks again for sharing your music with us.
Thank you very much.
You're looking forward.
Great, thanks. International Guitar Night comes to Corvallis on Saturday, February 3rd at the Whiteside Theater downtown. Check out internationalguitarnight.com. I'll leave you with some of the music of Minnie Marks from Australia. For KORC, I'm Lava Lamp Larry.
through geranium eyes.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics, a program heard every Sunday afternoon here on KORC from 1 to 2 p.m. You can find us locally on 105.9 FM. We are streaming worldwide at KORCFM.com. The Corvallis School District announces the upcoming Benton County Career Convention, an event tailored toward 11th graders in our community. This is set to take place on February 26th at Oregon State University. That's a Monday. And this annual convention aims to provide students with real-world insights and experiential learning opportunities. The local school district is reaching out to the community to invite volunteers to contribute to the success of this event. There are several roles available for volunteers, including mock interviewers, where you will help students hone their interview skills by participating in mock interviews. Also, career panel participants, where you can share your professional journey and insights on a career panel. Event support, where you can assist in checking in and directing students to ensure a smooth and organized experience. Or community partners. You can be a community partner to this effort by sharing services, internship opportunities, or information on summer employment for young people. Please note that all volunteers are required to complete the Corvallis School District volunteer application, which is online at the Corvallis School District website, which I will give in just a moment. This is an opportunity for community members to play an active role in shaping the future of our students. By contributing your time and expertise, you are part of their learning experience, and you can be a crucial part in creating an engaging learning environment. For more information, you are encouraged to contact High School Coordinator Nikki McFarland at 541-757-3966. That phone number is 541-757-3966 for High School Coordinator Nikki McFarland. You can go online to www.csd509j.net. That's csd509j.net. That is the website for the Corvallis School District. That's the upcoming Benton County Career Convention taking place at Oregon State University, Monday, February 26th. There is more information at csd509j.net, the Corvallis School District website, where qualified applicants can also search available careers in the school district. This is KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Dan Krall.
KORC is looking for volunteer local reporters to tell the stories that aren't getting told. So if you have something to share, an expert opinion, or even just anything cool you think people should know about, write us at info@korcfm.com and let's talk. And join us on Sundays to hear local news, interviews, and stories that aren't getting told anywhere else.
Everybody, I'm Lava Lamp Larry with another edition of Beaver Tales. We're going to check out everything that happened in OSU sports this past week. Let's start with the basketball team. They had a big assignment Thursday night at Gill. The men's basketball team took on number 9 Arizona. The highlight of the game actually might have been freshman Leo Kaplan hitting a half-court shot. But that wasn't part of the game because he's not on the team. Leo hit a layup, a three-pointer, and then amazed the crowd with a half-court shot to win a pair of diamond earrings. And then he promptly put them on and enjoyed the rest of the game. But really the most epic shot of the night might have been Jordan Pope's. It was a back-and-forth game all night long, but with the score tied at 80-80 and just a few seconds left, Pope took the ball all the way down the court, hit a three-pointer in the corner at the buzzer to give the Beavers a three-point win over number 9 Arizona. No diamond earrings for him, but Pope left Gill Coliseum with 34 points to show off. Arizona really has far more talent, but on Thursday night, Jordan Pope was the best player on the floor. Next up for the men's team is a game next week at USC against Bronny James and company, followed by home games the following week versus Washington State on February 8th. Go Pack 2! And Washington on Saturday, February 12th. Meanwhile, the women's basketball team moved into the rankings at number 25. And just before I recorded this session of Beaver Tales, the ladies played number 3 Colorado Friday and then took on number 16 Utah today. The Pac-12 is just loaded with great teams, and the Lady Beavers hope to become one of them. Beaver baseball starts February 16th at Arizona when they play games every day. And surprise, Arizona, they're ranked 7th and 9th nationally in 2 preseason polls. In men's wrestling, the squad split 2 matches last week, beating Cal Poly and then dropping a road match at the other black and orange OSU, Oklahoma State. The Beavs are now 5-3 on the year. Go Beavs! For KORC, this is Beaver Tales, and I'm Lava Lamp Larry.
This is Merch Pop for Community Voices on KORC. On November 28, 2023, Darren Nichols, Director of Community Development for Benton County, appeared before the Board of Commissioners. His presentation appeared designed to convince the board to halt the meeting of the Disposal Site Advisory Committee and restructure it to limit critical comment from some residents regarding the Coffin Butte landfill. He accomplished this goal. His tactics for doing so leave much to be desired in terms of ethical communication. Fully 7 minutes of his 28-minute presentation were taken up by unsubstantiated accusations and toxic insinuations stated vaguely enough to skirt obvious legal defamation charges. Over the next few weeks, 4 DSAC members presented evidence of Nichols' false claims and a detailed critique of the vague and misleading nature of his accusations. There was no response from the county to requests for retraction and correction of the record. At the December 19th Board of Commissioners meeting, 2 DSAC members spoke during the public comment portion of the board meeting. After our remarks, Commissioner Augereau stated, "I have a very hard time when we go over and over water that's under the bridge." Generally, this idiom is used when a matter has been discussed by both parties and resolved in some manner. None of our comments, written or oral, have been addressed in any way, at least publicly, by the Board of Commissioners. Commissioner Wise then repeated, thereby amplifying a particularly inflammatory debunked claim. Allowing a public official to defame and denigrate members of the community who serve on advisory boards is not in the spirit of openness and community, and especially flies in the face of the Supportive People and Resources plank of the Benton County 2040 Thriving Communities Core Values Statement. The thing is, lots of us residents truly have those values, and we want to see them played out by our leaders on a day-to-day basis. We want ethical, intelligent, and forward-thinking leaders who walk the walk. We are seeing a disturbing parallel between the disparagement of county residents who serve on the DSAC and the abrupt charges brought against a Corvallis City Councilor. In both cases, local government officials seem to be engineering the efforts to consolidate their own power. It appears as though there is an effort underway to disempower community input when it speaks inconvenient truths to power. Our city and county elected officials need to remember that their job is to work in the interest of and uphold the values of our residents, not to protect their staff's desire to operate above criticism. It is the job of our leadership to monitor and guide civic staff, not the other way around. Although state law, ORS 459.320, specifies that DSAC function as a local citizens advisory committee, this week, county staff released a proposed change to the DSAC bylaws. These changes will effectively take all administration responsibility from the DSAC chair and transfer it to the community development director. Benton County staff will then be in complete control of DSAC. At the January 23 Board of Commissioners meeting, Mr. Nichols presented this version of the bylaws for approval. Commissioner Augereau pushed back on a few of the most egregious power grab attempts, but it is clear that if the Board of Commissioners approves new bylaws, anything like these, the future direction of DSAC will lie not in the hands of local residents as suggested by state law, but with unelected Benton County staff. Perhaps we all need to keep a watchful eye on the motivations and actions of our local bureaucracy. The saying, "Democracy dies in darkness," seems relevant in this moment. This is Marge Pop for Community Voices on KORC.
During heavy rainfall, localized flooding can cause unexpected hazards. If you see significant floodwaters on the road, do not attempt to drive through, especially if the road is marked closed. Even heavy-duty vehicles can lose traction and begin to float away, which is then a game-changer for safety and, in some cases, your survival. 2 inches or more is all it takes to lift some vehicles to float off the road. Do not drive through floodwaters or closed roads. You can visit tripcheck.com or call 511 to get updates on highway conditions. If your property is flooding and you need to evacuate, remember to unplug all electronics and appliances and turn off your electricity at your circuit box. Also, turn off your water and gas valves. Have an emergency plan and be ready to follow evacuation orders, particularly if you live in a flood zone. Benton County flooding is caused by rivers and streams overflowing during high rain or storm events. Localized flooding can happen as a result of overloaded, blocked, or inadequate stormwater drainage systems that cause sheet flow into streets and low-lying areas, then pooling in yards, sewer backups, and basement or first-floor flooding. Most flooding occurs between November and April, though with a changing climate and often increasingly catastrophic weather events, it's good to always be prepared. You can see your flood hazard zone by doing an internet search for My Flood Hazard Zone and follow the link to the FEMA.gov website, FEMA.gov. You're listening to KORC, Community Radio for Corvallis, on 105.9 LPFM or streaming at KORCFM.com.
What's up? Glowcat with a PSA about unleashed dogs. Okay, with a name like Glowcat, I might sound a little biased, so let me just start by saying that I'm fond of dogs and have had many in my life. But here's the thing. I didn't expect to have bitten by a dog on my bingo card this past year, but here I am, a dog bite victim. Don't worry, I'm okay. But what if I wasn't? Even the friendliest dogs can have mystery triggers or unexpected encounters that make them nervous and reactive. So unless you have incredible voice control over them, why risk it? Leash your dog in public. It's the responsible thing to do.